Genesis 40 to 41:37, the 38th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on September 28, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I couldn't help but notice that this week nobody said, "How about them ducks?" So, but I won't mention it. Okay, I'm trying to pace myself to finish up Genesis in my allotted period of time, so I'm going to go through quite a bit of text today. I think I can make it and still leave time for questions. That's certainly what I have intended. Last week, you looked at chapter 39, in which Joseph was very unjustly treated. He was falsely accused of having tried to rape his master's wife. And he was actually trying to avoid her advances. And nevertheless, he was accused of trying to rape her, and he was thrown into prison. And I mentioned how his life has been a kind of roller coaster, where he has had very unjust things happen to him that have been very devastating. And then God will start to act in his life in such a way that things begin to improve in his conditions in ways that he couldn't have anticipated, couldn't have expected, only to be followed by another, even more serious disappointment. So there have been more downs than ups in his life, but nevertheless, apparent that God's been at work behind the scenes. And we'll see that same pattern continuing in chapter 40. Chapter 40, verses 1 through 8. Then it came about after these things, the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt defended their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was furious with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. So he put them in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard in the jail, the same place where Joseph was imprisoned. And the captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of them, and he took care of them. And they were in confinement for some time. Then the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt, who were confined in jail, both had a dream the same night, each man with his own dream and each dream with its own interpretation. When Joseph came to them in the morning and observed them, behold, they were dejected. And he asked Pharaoh's officials, who were with him in confinement in his master's house, "Why are your faces so sad today?" Then they said to him, "We have had a dream, and there is no one to interpret it." Then Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please." So there are two officials of Pharaoh's administration that have been thrown in jail, the same place where Joseph is. Don't let their names mislead you. Cupbearer doesn't sound very significant, but to be the cupbearer to the king is a very high-ranking official. And we have evidence that the cupbearer to the king of Egypt was a very high-ranking official. There are two reasons why the cupbearer is a high-ranking official. One is he is in charge of providing the drink to the king. And in times of court intrigue, it was important to make sure to have someone who you could trust who was providing you with drink, because it could always be poisoned. So that has to be someone that he trusts. The other thing to keep in mind is anyone who has frequent contact with the king is going to have influence. And that's been true historically down the ages, that those people who have the most contact with a king typically have disproportionate amount of influence. And it's the same phenomenon that we hear about nowadays. Every once in a while, there'll be a flap in the White House about which official has their office the closest to the president's office. Well, what's that all about? Well, if your office is close to the president's office, you will see him more often. And if you see him more often, you will have more influence. So in the ancient times, to be the cupbearer, that's significant. That's like Secretary of State or something like that. It's not menial. The same with the baker, the same kind of phenomenon. So the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, these are high-ranking officials. These are members of the Pharaoh's cabinet, so to speak. And they have been put in prison because, as the text says, very literally, they have sinned against the king. So apparently they aren't just accused of doing wrong, at least from the narrator's perspective. They have done something wrong. They have done something to upset the king. So they've been thrown in prison. And apparently they've been put in prison as a temporary measure until the king can decide how to dispose of the matter. The prison that they're placed in is the same prison that Joseph was thrown into. It appears to be a prison, a special prison, for people who have committed white-collar crime or something of that nature. And this prison is located, apparently, on the estate of Potiphar. Potiphar being the master, the one who had bought Joseph. So Potiphar, the captain of the bodyguard, apparently has this prison on his estate, and to one degree or another is overseeing this prison. These high-ranking officials have been placed in this prison, and as you can imagine, Potiphar has an interest in making sure that they are well cared for, because these are important people. He doesn't know what is going to happen to them. But it is probably wise to treat important people well. I mean, that's the pattern. And Potiphar is following that pattern. So he assigns Joseph to look after the needs of these important prisoners. So Joseph takes that on as his responsibility. It says in my text that they were there for some time. Literally, it's they were there for days. It's hard to know what that means. Some interpret it to mean they were there for a considerable length of time. Others that it was just a matter of days. There is one rabbinic tradition that takes that phrase to mean 1 year. And they cite evidence that that phrase elsewhere means 1 year. If that's the case, then they were thrown in prison at about Pharaoh's birthday, 1 year, and they stay there a whole year, and we'll see what happens at the next time of Pharaoh's birthday. In any case, they're there for some period of time. It's not just a couple of days. They both have dreams on the same night. And apparently they share with each other the fact that they had dreams, and they may have told each other their dreams. And if so, they probably would have been struck by the similarities in the dreams. This must have been ominous to them. They both dream on the same night, and the dreams have some similar themes. And they must be thinking, this, and especially in a culture where dreams are considered to be communications from God, they must be looking at these as a very significant event. So they've compared notes, and they are depressed, and visibly depressed. Joseph shows up for work, And he immediately notices that both of his charges are depressed. And he asks them, what is the source of their depression? And their response is, we had a dream, and there's no one here to interpret it. So what's really significant to them is there's no one there who can tell them what these clearly portentous dreams, what they mean. And Joseph's response is an interesting one. He says, interpretation belongs to God. I mean, it's a rhetorical question. Do not interpretations belong to God? He's making an important claim here. What he's saying is, it's not the skill of the interpreter that is what will lead you to an understanding of this dream. That an understanding of this dream can only originate from God himself. And Joseph, given his experiences, seems to be confident that God has been working behind the scenes to prepare this kind of opportunity. And he's convinced that he will be able to tell them the meaning of his dream. So he has them tell the dream to him. Verses 9 through 15. So the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph and said to him, in my dream, behold, there was a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches. And as it was budding, its blossoms came out, and its clusters produced ripe grapes. Now Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, so I took the grapes and squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. Then Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you will put Pharaoh's cup into his hand according to your former custom when you were his cupbearer. Only keep me in mind when it goes well with you, and please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house. For I was in fact kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing that they should have put me into the dungeon. So the cupbearer tells this dream, and the dream is not bizarre. In fact, it's quite fitting with what the cupbearer has done in his office. The only thing that's really unusual about it is it's in fast time. Time-lapse photography. That he sees the vines growing and the blossoms appear, buds and the blossoms and the grapes, and he reaches out and squeezes the grapes into the cup and then gives that cup to the king. So it's all like it's in time-lapse photography, but it's really, there's nothing bizarre in the dream. If you're familiar with the story, it's as though the meaning just kind of flows out of the dream. If you already know the interpretation, it's as though that's what had to have been the interpretation. But if you think about it, that dream could mean a lot of things. This dream is not clear. It's not transparent. And let me give you just one example. The number 3 is prominent in the dream. But how would you know that the number 3 is to be related to time? Why couldn't it relate to something else? And even if it relates to time, how would you know the units of time? Is it 3 hours? 3 days? 3 weeks? 3 years? I see no indication that would point us towards one unit of time over another. So the dream could be interpreted a lot of different ways, it seems to me. The meaning does not just flow out of it. And yet, Joseph, without hesitation, comes up with an interpretation. And the interpretation does does relate to the dream itself. What he says is that there will be 3 days that will pass, and after that time, the cupbearer's head will be lifted up. That means there will be something encouraging, something that will cheer him up. In 3 days, his head will be lifted up. He will be restored to his office as cupbearer. Then Joseph asks a favor. Apparently, the custom in Egypt was there were people who interpreted dreams as a profession. I don't remember what phone number it was, but you called in, give the dream, and they tell you the meaning of it. And generally speaking, a charge, there was a fee charged for that service. Joseph is not charging a fee, but he does ask a favor. And I think that what he says here is particularly interesting. He says, "Remember me, please." I mean, he's polite about it. Please remember me and mention me to the Pharaoh so that the Pharaoh might get me out of here. Basically, and then he launches into just a brief explanation as to how he got here in this prison, and indicating that he's actually blameless. That first he was kidnapped from his homeland, brought to Egypt, and then was falsely accused, and he had done nothing wrong, and yet was put into prison. Now, this is interesting for several reasons. The first is, although he has been working closely with the cupbearer for some time, apparently this is the first time he's told them his story. It's never come up before. He hasn't advanced it. He hasn't been going around the prison saying, "I shouldn't be here. I was falsely accused." The second is, if you look at the account closely, there is no one that he is blaming for it. He tends to use passive voice here, avoiding an agent. He doesn't say anything about his brothers. He says, "I was kidnapped." But he doesn't say who did it. And then he says, "And here in Egypt, I have done nothing wrong." So he isn't blaming anyone. And the third is, he does nothing to play on their pity, on the cupbearer's pity. He could throw in lots of details here that would have made it a much sadder tale, and they would have been true details. But he leaves those out. This is a bare-bones account. All he is claiming is, there is no just reason why I'm here. But he's not holding anyone to blame, nor is he playing upon the pity of the cupbearer. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. Verses 16 through 23. When the chief baker saw that he had interpreted favorably, he said to Joseph, "I also saw in my dream, and behold, there were 3 baskets of white bread on my head. And in the top basket, there were some of all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh, and the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head." Then Joseph answered and said, "This is its interpretation. The 3 baskets are 3 days. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and will hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh off you." Thus it came about on the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all his servants. And he lifted up the head of the servant of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. And he restored the chief cupbearer to his office, and he put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker, just as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. So the chief baker has heard the interpretation that Joseph has given to the chief cupbearer and apparently is encouraged and thinks, oh, well, I'm going to get mine interpreted and maybe mine will be equally encouraging. That seems to be what's going on. So he tells his story, and again, his dream is not, it's not bizarre. He's doing what he did before he was thrown in prison. In his dream, he's doing what he did. And part of that is he has baked some goods for the Pharaoh, put them into baskets, stacked those baskets up, and he's carrying them on his head. There is the one twist on it, and that is birds come and start eating out of the top basket. But that's all there is in the dream. So he tells this dream to Joseph. Joseph, again, without hesitation, gives an interpretation of the dream. And again, the number three is prominent. And again, I would argue the interpretation does not just fall out of the vision. There are a number of interpretations that could be given to that vision, it seems to me. But Joseph says that what is going to happen, that this too is predictive, in 3 days, the chief baker is going to be beheaded. That he too is in a sense going to have his head lifted, but in a very different sense. He's going to be beheaded, and then his corpse is going to be thrown out for the birds to eat. And in Egyptian culture, it was important for your body to be intact when you died. That your body needed to be intact in order for you to pass into the afterlife. That's why the mummification, etc. So this is a particularly frightening interpretation to this dream. He's going to be beheaded, and his body's going to be picked apart by the birds. So those are the two interpretations. 3 days later, his interpretations come true, both of them. The cupbearer is restored to his official position. The baker has his head lopped off, and he's thrown out for the birds to eat. So both of his interpretations have been validated. That must have been an exciting moment for Joseph, in a sense, that he has his interpretations have been validated, and surely this will draw the attention of the Pharaoh, would be reported to Pharaoh and draw his attention. But he has another disappointment, as we've seen before. The cupbearer forgot. I mean, in all the excitement of being reestablished to his position, he forgets all about Joseph. And as we see, he has to wait 2 years, two more years. I mean, God is really stretching out the timeline on Joseph here. He allows a lot of time to pass for these disappointments to soak in and for him to have the potential of turning those disappointments into bitterness. But that's not what Joseph does. Joseph is able to see behind the scenes that God is working. Okay, next section, chapter 41, verses 1 through 8. Now it happened at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream. And behold, he was standing by the Nile. And lo, from the Nile there came up 7 cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed in the marsh grass. Then behold, 7 other cows came up after them from the Nile, ugly and gaunt. And they stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. And the ugly and gaunt cows ate up the 7 sleek and fat cows. Then Pharaoh awoke. And he fell asleep and dreamed a second time. And behold, 7 ears of grain came up on a single stalk, plump and good. Then behold, 7 ears, thin and scorched by the east wind, sprouted up after them. and the thin ears swallowed up the 7 plump and full ears. Then Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. Now it came about in the morning that his spirit was troubled. So he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. And Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them to Pharaoh. So 2 years have passed, and now Pharaoh has 2 dreams in the same night. The first one starts out very realistically, as I understand it. Apparently, it was quite common, and still today in Egypt, for cattle, when it is hot during the day, to go into the river to cool off. So the scene we have here is cattle who have been in the river now are coming up to the shoreline to eat the grass along the shores of the river. And there are seven of them initially, and they are all well filled out, healthy, good-looking cows coming out to eat the grass. But then they are followed by 7 cows that are really skinny. And they too come out of the Nile, and they walk up towards the shoreline. But here's where the dream gets a little weird. These skinny cows eat the fat cows. Now at this point, I mean, if it's like my dreams, it's not uncommon for them to start out normal and turn weird. And just at that point when they turn weird, it's kind of, oh, this is ominous. It can be downright frightening at that point where it turns weird, especially when it turns weird this way. Kind of, it's unnatural. So he wakes up, and my suspicion is he wakes up disturbed. But the night's young, he goes back to sleep. He has another dream, and this one, too, starts out quite normally. It's just some kind of grain, and I don't know what kind of grain it's describing here, but grain grows, and we have 7 grains on one stalk, and they're all healthy-looking grain. But then we have 7 other grains that grow up, and I'm not sure whether they're on separate stalks or whether they're all on the same stalk. But this is scorched by the east wind. The east winds in the Nile area, as I understand it from the commentaries, that's where the scorching winds that dry out the crops would often come from. And these withered grains then eat up the fat grains. So once again, this one turns kind of weird and a little ominous. So Pharaoh wakes up in the morning. He's had these 2 dreams, both of them weird and a little ominous. And I suspect rather vivid dreams. I don't dream often. And sometimes I have the vague recollection that I did dream, but I can't recall any of the parts. I can't recall what actually happened. But occasionally I will have a dream that when I wake up, it's clear as day. It's one of those that I know exactly what happened. And usually those are the disturbing ones. I suspect that's the kind of experience that Pharaoh has had in this case. So he calls in the wise men, the interpreters of dreams. There are people who do this professionally, as I mentioned before. He calls them in. They're all stumped. Now, I find it hard to believe that they couldn't come up with any interpretation. It seems to me that one could concoct an interpretation. The question is it one that I am willing to tell to the Pharaoh and risk the consequences for it being wrong? And no one's willing to do that. Verses 9, let's see, how far am I going? 9 to 13. Then the chief cupbearer spoke to Pharaoh, saying, I would make mention today of my own offenses. Pharaoh was furious with his servants. And he put me in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard, both me and the chief baker. And we had a dream on the same night, he and I. Each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now a Hebrew youth was with us there, a servant of the captain of the bodyguard. And we related them to him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. To each one he interpreted according to his own dream. And it came about that just as he had interpreted for us, so it happened. He restored me in my office, but he hanged him. So the chief cupbearer is put in an awkward situation. He now remembers Joseph and what Joseph had done in the prison. And here is a situation in which the Pharaoh is looking for a good interpreter of dreams. Joseph would qualify, but in order for him to tell how he knows of Joseph, he has to remind the Pharaoh of the time when he was in Pharaoh's displeasure. But he does so. He reminds Pharaoh of the situation, says, remember when you threw us in prison? Well, there we met a Hebrew slave who was able to interpret our dreams. He interpreted my dream and the baker's dream, and both of them turned out exactly as he had said they would. Reading on, 14 through 24. Then Pharaoh sent and called for Joseph, and they hurriedly brought him out of the dungeon. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have had a dream, but no one can interpret it. And I have heard it said about you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Joseph then answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. So Pharaoh spoke to Joseph. In my dream, behold, I was standing on the bank of the Nile, and behold, seven cows, fat and sleek, came up out of the Nile. And they grazed in the marsh grass. And lo, seven other cows came up after them, poor and very ugly and gaunt, such as I had never seen for ugliness in all the land of Egypt. And the lean and ugly cows ate up the first seven fat cows. Yet when they had devoured them, it could not be detected that they had devoured them, for they were just as ugly as before. Then I awoke. I saw also in my dream, and behold, seven ears, full and good, came up on a single stalk. And lo, seven ears, withered thin and scorched by the east wind, sprouted up after them. And the seven ears swallowed the seven good ears. Then I told it to the magicians, but there was no one who could explain it to me. So they bring Joseph out of the prison. They shave him, clean him up, give him clean clothes so that he'll be presentable to stand before the Pharaoh. He goes before the Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says, I hear you interpret dreams. I'm in the market for a good dream and interpreter. And Joseph's response is similar to what he had said to the cupbearer and the baker. He says, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. That God is the one from whom interpretations come. It's not up to interpreters. So Pharaoh tells the dreams to Joseph. There are a couple of details in his retelling here that were not in the original accounts. One is, he says that there were the fat cows, the seven fat cows. And when he talks about the seven lean cows, he goes out of his way to say they were really ugly. They were really skinny. So he's stressing that particular point, whereas he had not earlier. The other difference is that when these skinny cows ate the fat cows, the skinny cows were still skinny. And that's a significant fact that Joseph draws upon later. Okay, Joseph's interpretation, verse 25. Now Joseph said to Pharaoh, Pharaoh's dreams are one and the same. God has told to Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good ears are 7 years. The dreams are one and the same. And the seven lean and ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years, and the seven thin ears scorched by the east wind shall be 7 years of famine. It is as I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Behold, 7 years of great abundance are coming in all the land of Egypt. And after them, 7 years of famine will come, and all the abundance will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will ravage the land. So the abundance will be unknown in the land because of that subsequent famine, for it will be very severe. Now, as for the repeating of the dream to Pharaoh twice, it means that the matter is determined by God, and God will quickly bring it about. And now let Pharaoh look for a man discerning and wise, and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh take action to appoint overseers in charge of the land, and let him exact a fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 years of abundance. Then let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming, and store up the grain for food in the cities under Pharaoh's authority, and let them guard it. And let the food become as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine, which will occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish during the famine. Now the proposal seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his servants. So Pharaoh told him the dream, and Joseph interprets it. And he says, both of the dreams have essentially the same meaning. They are prophetic. That there are going to be 7 years in which there will be abundance in Egypt. But those will be followed by 7 years of famine. And that famine will be extremely severe. So severe that anything produced in the first 7 years will be more than consumed. And the reason that there are two dreams is because it's going to happen soon. So that's the interpretation that Joseph gives unhesitatingly. Then Joseph launches into some advice. He wasn't asked for it, but he lays out a plan for dealing with this coming catastrophe. And what he suggests is that the Pharaoh appoint someone who is wise and discerning to oversee this whole project of preparing for provision, food provisions for Egypt to extend over the next 14 years. And that person in charge of the whole project ought to appoint some people under him who will supervise this project locally. And I think that's what it means here. My interpretation says, and let him exact a fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 years of abundance. But that's a questionable interpretation. That verb could mean to divide it into fifths, to divide the land into fifths. That makes more sense to me. I suspect that's what's happening. What he's suggesting is divide Egypt into five regions and appoint an overseer over each of those regions. And they will be responsible to the one who's supervising the whole project. And it will be their job to collect excess produce throughout the 7 years and store them in the cities locally to where they're produced. Then when the supplies run low, they can draw upon those storehouses locally made that can then be distributed to the people and used when food gets short. And if they're stored in the cities, the storage can be supervised and they can be guarded. But they will also be close to where they were produced, they can be distributed to that area easily. So that's the plan that Joseph is suggesting. Now, why does Joseph go into this plan? I mean, he wasn't asked for the plan. Why does he do it? Is he making himself a candidate for the overseer job? My suspicion is that that's not what's motivating him. Because we haven't seen up to this time Joseph being that forward, that self-promoting. In fact, it's been just the opposite. He has not been self-promoting. I think that he has interpreted the dreams, and it has occurred to him that there's a simple way of dealing with this problem, and he just uses this opportunity to be helpful. It's just something for Pharaoh to consider. Because I by this time, well, I'll talk about it in just a second. Okay. So he tells the plan to Pharaoh, and all of this sounds very attractive and interesting to Pharaoh. Okay. So that's where we'll cut off the narrative part for today. Let me point out a couple of things here. The first thing I'd like to observe is that Joseph has matured significantly over the period of time that we have seen him in Genesis. And there are a number of indications that I have tried to highlight that Joseph has reached the point where I believe that he truly trusts God to take care of his fate. There is a kind of quiet confidence in Joseph that has been developed, such that he doesn't grasp at opportunities desperately and see them as, I've just got to use this to get out of my dilemma. It's not that he doesn't take opportunities, because he does. But he doesn't take them desperately. And when they don't turn out quite the way that he might have hoped, he doesn't fall into the depths of despair. He's able to get things into perspective and remind himself, you know, God is in control. And he does have my interests in mind. One way or another, he will take care of me. It may look desperate, but it's not desperate. It is not clear to me whether the dreams that Joseph had had earlier, where his brothers and his parents bowed down to him, whether he remembers those. Later in the narrative, we will see that he does remember them. They come to mind. But my suspicion is that because that's brought up in the narrative in the way that it is, that at this point in the narrative, he has ceased to think about those dreams. He's forgotten them. They've gone to the back of his mind. So I don't think that he's deriving confidence from those dreams at this point. The confidence comes from him having observed God working in his life. There are just too many indications that God has orchestrated this whole thing and is working it out in his best interests. The other thing that strikes me in this passage and in the previous passage is Joseph is truly gifted. He is gifted in a couple of ways. God has given him talents and abilities. And he's made a slave. But in his position as a slave, he works his way up. See that throughout. I mean, he rises to a place where he is the top administrator in Egypt, as we will see, and carries out those duties very, very well. So he's obviously got talent, ability. But God has developed those talents and abilities. He started when he was a slave and helped him develop some of those abilities. Then in the prison, he helps him develop those abilities. So when he is placed in the position of high authority under Pharaoh, there's a sense in which he's well prepared for it. It's not the course of preparation that someone would have suggested that he take. I mean, he didn't go to college to study administration. He gained those skills in another way. But that's what's so remarkable about this. It was just an unusual way in which he gained those skills, obviously superintended by God. That seems to be God's pattern, that God takes people in whom he has already instilled, has granted gifts and talents, and then in his own way, sometimes orthodox, sometimes unorthodox, he develops those skills and talents for his specific purposes for that person. I mean, just another example that comes readily to mind would be David, who was a shepherd, but as a shepherd developed the skills that he would need later on, both as a commander in the military and then as a king. And one example of that is when he goes against Goliath. The rest of the military were afraid to go against Goliath, but David, given his training and background, has the confidence that he can take Goliath on. He does it in an unorthodox fashion because his background is unorthodox. But he has nevertheless been trained for the task. So Joseph is being trained for the task. But all along it keeps saying that God caused him to prosper. It isn't his talents and his abilities that are bringing about the success. They are playing a role, but the success is something that God is bringing about. One could be the most gifted and talented person in the world and not gain success. There are too many things that are out of our control. The success has to come from not just talent and ability, but also God making that possible. It's important, I think, to remember that our gifts, whatever they are, whether there are talents and abilities or other things that God has given us, they're all from God. And they are there only as long as God wants them to be there. Any gifts or any talents or abilities that we develop, God could take at any time. They aren't ours. They're only ours on loan. And it's hard to keep that in mind. There's a tendency to think, well, I have learned this skill. This skill is mine. But any skill could be taken away. And God does do that. We have examples of that. Samson comes to mind. And so it's interesting when he says interpretation is of God. He has things in perspective here, that if he is going to be able to interpret the dreams of the cupbearer and the baker and the dreams of Pharaoh, those interpretations are going to be a gift of God, not the result of the skill and talent. He may have some skill and talent for interpreting dreams, but ultimately, the interpretation has to come from God. He's the one who grants it. So Joseph is truly gifted, and God has developed his talents and abilities. But more importantly, God is working behind the scenes. God is the one who's bringing about the success. And Joseph has come to the place where he can see that. He sees God's fingerprints on everything that's happened to him. And that gives him a great deal of confidence that God will continue to work in his life. Okay. Questions, comments?
I had a couple of observations. In my little American perspective, I kind of have this idea that God only speaks to the President of the United States and doesn't really speak to the Saddam Husseins and those kind of people. And I found it kind of interesting that God spoke to Pharaoh, you know, this ungodly kind of slave owner, bad guy kind of thing. And that God indeed cares about all people and not just some people, and though perhaps Pharaoh was a stepping stone to something greater God wanted to do, nonetheless, God used Pharaoh. So I think that kind of helps at least me change kind of my perspective about the universal attribute that God has a whole system, and not just an American system that's kind of in motion. And then secondarily, I was thinking if I was in Joseph's position, giving kind of the Pharaoh the good news, bad news kind of scenario that he did, I mean, that's pretty ominous news. And it seems like there would be a penalty if you gave an interpretation to a dream like that, that's like, and by the way, everybody's going to die. You know, if that's kind of the end of this story, that there would seem to be some pressure on Joseph to kind of have to say, but it isn't all that bad. I've got a plan to kind of do that. And I'm wondering if that could have been motivated by fear in Joseph, like, by the way, it isn't all that bad. We can kind of fix this.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. And it may not have been fear just as much as helping Pharaoh to put things into perspective. It may sound really ominous, but it isn't as ominous as it may. This is actually good news.
Right.
Because you're given the opportunity to prepare for this and make it possible to survive it.
When you have said several times God's working behind the scenes a lot in Joseph's life, and it's made me think we look back at Joseph's story and we really look at how God brought about his success. I'm wondering for some things I was thinking about previous teachings I've had. When God, in this setting, it's easy to think, okay, about how God was sovereign in everything that happened in Joseph's life. But from a modern Christian perspective, where we think of God as behind the scenes, when the trials come to Joseph, without knowing the whole story, it seems to me like some teachings would be, well, God never brings trials to us, but he works through them when they come to make our success happen. And I don't know if that's kind of a stretch, but it just was connecting in my mind that do we know for sure, and how do we know from the text that God brought trials, such as, you know, the cupbearer forgot Joseph, but God was, you know, God had his plan in action, but this was the glitch in the road. If God didn't bring the trial, the cupbearer's choice did, but he was still going to carry out his plan for Joseph's success no matter what. There are two different ways of looking at it.
If Joseph were to look at that way, he would have to say, it has been very fortuitous that all of those things happened, and God is extremely creative in bringing good out of each of those things, which I suppose is possible. But we see later in Genesis, there's the verse that is one of my favorite verses in all of Genesis, where the brothers, after the death of Jacob, they're afraid that Joseph is going to turn on him, on them, because their father's gone. And Joseph is really hurt because they think that he's been hiding his disdain for them all those years. But he says, you, when he is reflecting back on the time that they sold him into slavery, he says, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. But there is a double intention in the act. And I think what Pharaoh has learned is there's a double intention in everything that happens. There's the intention of the agent, that is, a human agent, as well as the intention of the sovereign God who's working out his purposes. That both are true at the same time. What you said at the beginning reminded me, I don't know if I mentioned it in here, but in response to questions afterwards, this has come up. It is interesting to note that God does not speak to Joseph in the book of Genesis anywhere directly. God does not appear to Joseph. He did to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to all three of them. So in Jewish tradition, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are all patriarchs. Joseph is not considered to be one of the patriarchs. So there's a sense in which I identify more closely with Joseph. God has never spoken to me audibly, and he has never appeared to me. So I can identify with this much more. But you read this, and it looks like God is active at every moment in Joseph's life. But it's really important to keep your chronology straight, because that's stretched way out. There's a lot of time in between the events that are listed. And if you were to tell the whole story of Joseph's life, my suspicion is it would look a lot more like mine. There's a lot of the mundane between those instances where God's activity clearly protrudes into our daily affairs. For the most part, it's just normal day-to-day stuff. And I think if I'm honest and I look at my own life, there are times when God has done things that were clear indications to me of his activity. But they're spaced out over years. It's not a daily event. It's a rare event where that's clearly the case. And I think that's what we have with Joseph as well.
Do Egyptologists know which pharaoh this was? Like King Tut's granddad or something like that?
No, they don't. This is really tricky. I think it's in Exodus, it has the verse, a pharaoh rose up who did not know Joseph. There was an event in Egyptian history that was left out of the Egyptian textbooks, but Egypt was invaded and conquered by some peoples from the north called the Hyksos. They invaded and took over a large section of Egypt and controlled it for, I think, a couple of centuries. And it looks suspiciously like it was, and the area that they conquered and controlled, they lived in as rulers, but they were a small minority of that area. The vast majority were Egyptian. They adopted Egyptian culture. And it looks suspiciously like the pharaoh here might be a Hyksos pharaoh. And the Exodus occurs after the Hyksos are kicked out of Egypt and it is an Egyptian pharaoh that comes into power. But that's real iffy. It's not clear.
The historians record the failures of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but with Joseph, he pitches a perfect game.
Yeah.
And why do you suppose that is?
I think that it's telling a different story. I think what we're seeing in Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is God working through their failings. That their personal failings become part of the theme that's being hit there. In Joseph, I don't think it's his personal failings, it's his circumstances that God is showing, that God is overcoming his circumstances. I don't know why they didn't choose to pick that personal theme as much here, but that seems to be the case. Okay, thanks.